So how's your email inbox these days? Are you staying on top of it, or is it ridiculous? Where's your to-do list? How about that? Are you getting stuff done? Do you have a system? And I know there's never enough time. Well, in a new book, the writer Oliver Berkman says the problem isn't limited time. The problem is that we've taken on these ideas about how to use our limited time. And it's not that we're not getting stuff done. The question is it the right stuff? Because this is all about our relationship with time. And to help people better understand it, he goes back to an age before we really measured time, before there were schedules, before there were clocks. He compares your life to the life of a medieval peasant in England.
I think life as a peasant in early medieval England would have been absolutely appalling in all sorts of ways. You would have had many, many problems of disease and backbreaking labor, exploitation, and in fact a very short average lifespan compared to today. But there is this sense we get from what we know about those times that you would not have had time-related problems. You wouldn't have felt too busy. You wouldn't have felt like life was moving too fast or even too slow. You wouldn't have felt like you had to make sure to use time well or that there was some reason to use it more efficiently. Not because people were just more relaxed or resigned to their fate, but because they, by and large, didn't think of time as a separate thing, as a thing that was separate from themselves that they then had to use well or keep pace with or that they were wasting. The rhythms of life just emerge from the tasks themselves. You milk the cows when they need milking, harvest the crops when they need harvesting. And it would have been completely insane to say to somebody in that position, you know, why don't you get all the milking for the month out of the way in one big batch today to save time later on? Obviously, that makes no sense. I think those people would generally have understood time, if they could even objectively characterize it at all, just as the medium in which life unfolded, not as something that was hounding them or that they had to try to use more efficiently. And so I don't think they would have had the specifically time-related problems that cause so many of us so much anxiety and stress today. When I am asked a question like, will you have time to do this extra thing tomorrow? How long is it until a certain work project is due? I'm thinking in some sort of visual image, a calendar, a clock face, a yardstick, little boxes of time that are passing by, something like that. And I'm trying to measure, you know, do I have enough of them to make space for the things I'm trying to fit into them?
But Berkman says if you compare that way of living to our peasant farmer who probably didn't experience time as a thing, there's a profound difference. Living like the farmer, he says, you can imagine how life would have felt expansive and fluid. Since he had no idea of time ticking away, Berkman writes, he might have experienced a heightened awareness of the vividness of things. It's what happens for some people in prayer or meditation.
I don't think we can go back to living like medieval peasants, nor that we should in any way, really. But just to understand that there is this other way of relating to time, to understand that there's something about how we relate to time that is contingent, that is a feature of our era and our way of thinking. And I think once you've sort of done that, you can loosen its grip a bit and you can see all the ways in which this particular way of relating to time as a resource that must be maximized, certain ways in which that gets us into trouble because it sets us off on these impossible quests to achieve total optimization and total productivity and total efficiency. So I think it's really useful just to realize that this exists in a broader context. There is another way.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Oliver Berkman is talking about his book, 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. It's about how we use the time we have, and the title gives you a sense of just about how much time we're talking.
As soon as I first figured out that 4,000 weeks is the approximate average human lifespan in the West expressed in terms of weeks, a little under 80 years, if you live to 80, you'll have had a few more than 4,000. I mean, I was just completely alarmed to make the calculation, because there is something about a week that is so short in our usual experience that one thinks there ought to be many more than 4,000 of them in an average life. So then I annoyed my friends by asking them to, you know, just surprising them and saying, like, tell me, you know, don't do any mental math. Just tell me how many weeks do you think average human lifespan is? And yeah, I remember one of the answers was something like 150,000. Now, obviously, if you stop to do the math, you realize that that is absurd. But if you don't stop to do the math, I don't think it's absurd at all. It feels like, sure. I mean, why shouldn't we have at least that many in something as long as a human life? But the truth is that if you double that and add a bit to 310,000, you get the number of weeks that is the duration of the entirety of human civilization since the ancient Sumerians of Mesopotamia. So, I mean, I think obviously we don't know how many weeks we're going to get. Some people get considerably more than 4,000, and of course some people get far fewer. The point really is just that there is this radical finitude built into human existence. And I suppose what I'm trying to argue is that we really don't take account of that in the ways that we generally approach the challenge of managing our daily time. And I don't think what I'm saying instead is that we should go around in this sort of white knuckle panic about how little time we have. I think it's that once you really sink into the truth of finitude, it's actually a sort of a liberation and a relief, because it means you can give up this impossible quest to try to do everything, because it becomes so obvious that you're not going to get to do everything in that amount of time. And then you can be a bit freer to focus on the things that really matter.
Yeah. You say in the book that you wrote it for yourself as much as anyone else. You said you were, I think you described yourself as a productivity geek at one point in your life. Talk about the kind of personal, I don't know if it's personal, but the kind of the dimension that of this book that you found in yourself, I guess.
Many, many books in this genre, whether the authors admit it or not, are written to grapple with things that they have been struggling with themselves. And in my case, yeah, I mean, I spent many, many years as what I would call, and others have called, you know, productivity geek, somebody who's really passionate about something in particular. Unfortunately, what that something in particular is, you know, finding more efficient ways to get things done. So it's not quite as romantic as being passionate about poetry or rock climbing or something. But I think what happened with me is that I gradually came to see, I was writing a column for the Guardian newspaper for years. One thing it involved was testing out all these, you know, books and systems of productivity and personal efficiency. I began to figure out that I was not going to suddenly discover the method that was going to leave me feeling completely in control of my life and unscared about certain kinds of major life decision that I was facing. I wasn't going to find this position of sort of total commanding mastery of time, nor was I going to wake up tomorrow with like 25,000 times as much self-discipline as I'd ever shown before in my life, which is also one of the premises of a lot of these methods. You're sort of like, oh, that's going to be great. I'm going to implement that tomorrow. Hang on. What my character to date doesn't suggest that I'm going to have that level of sort of rigorous self-discipline. So anyway, yeah, I mean, then it all sort of came to a head, and I write in the book about sitting on a park bench in Brooklyn on a winter morning with, you know, a bit more than even usual, making me feel overwhelmed, things I thought I had to get through that day, trying to plan out some genius scheduling mechanism that was going to enable me to get through it all. And just suddenly having this thought, like, none of this is ever going to work. Like, I'm never going to find the system that is going to deliver this emotional thing that I think I need, this sense of being totally in the driver's seat of time and able to take on anything that might be thrown at me and put into practice any ambition I might have and fulfill every obligation I might possibly feel. It's just never going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting about that moment when you write about, you say that this, your obsession with productivity had been serving what you describe as a hidden emotional agenda.
Right. I think this is a sort of a little more of a, maybe a psychoanalytic understanding of what's going on with these time management systems. I think that people are different. Not everyone is a productivity geek, and productivity geeks are not all like me, but we all have this thing, and I certainly was very much in the grip of it then, this feeling of being kind of constrained by reality, of not wanting to feel the ways in which reality imprisons us and forces us into certain situations. It forces us to make certain tough choices about how we're going to use our time. It forces us to see that, you know, pursuing one very valuable path for the next year of your life might be just incompatible with pursuing another path that might have been equally valuable. And also there's this kind of future focused aspect, right? That we sort of don't want to face up to the fact that we're in this ridiculously uncertain and vulnerable position, all of us, just in the moment with no possibility of knowing what's coming next. Anything could happen in the next moment. And it's always exactly that insecure for all of us, no matter how much we plan or try to convince ourselves otherwise. And I think that whole package of discomfort and anxiety and unpleasantness with regard to time is one that we'd much rather not feel. And so I should speak more personally, I was pursuing all sorts of methods of thinking about my time that were aimed at this notion that I could get to a place where I wouldn't have to feel those things. Of course, right. It was incompatible with reality. So it was always next week or next month or next year that this beautiful paradise was going to be reached. It was never right now.
Well, here's something you write that I think will get people's attention. Nobody in the history of humanity has ever achieved work-life balance, which is just crushing to hear in some ways. Like, this is what we're trying to do. But what you're saying early on in the book is, all right, guys, let's admit defeat, and then we can get on with it in some ways.
Right. I think this book is about it's encouraging a kind of defeat, a kind of surrender. Yeah. But as the prelude to then being able to do something really wonderful and possible with life, instead of spending your whole time being almost able to do something impossible, which I think is ultimately not a meaningful way to spend it. On work-life balance specifically, I mean, sure, who wouldn't want work-life balance? And maybe there are people who have achieved it in some sense, that they feel that they give appropriate amounts of time to those different domains of life. But what it means, that phrase, in the way that it is sort of broadcast at us, the way that we feel the pressure to try to attain it, I think is really it's this sort of mythical state of giving ourselves 100% to our work and giving ourselves 100% to our life outside work. And I think that's probably just a math problem that isn't going to be solved, because that's not how percentages work.
What are you seeing, because you write a bit about this movement of and discipline toward time management? Like, when you go into a bookstore and you go to that section, you know, the books and the courses, what are you seeing there? Because you say in the book that the problem isn't that the techniques or those products don't work, it's that they do work. So what are you seeing in them?
Right. I think that the point I'm trying to make there is that these ways of processing your tasks faster will very often help you process your tasks faster. But we live in an age, especially today, of what I call in the book infinite inputs. You know, there is no feasible limit to the number of emails you could receive, number of demands your boss could make. Likewise, to the number of exotic places you might want to visit on your bucket list, or the number of business ideas you might want to launch. They're not all negative, these infinite lists, but they are all negative. They're all infinite. And so if you get better at moving through them, you're actually not going to get any closer to the end, right? It's like getting faster and faster at climbing up an infinitely tall ladder. You're going to get faster and feel more rushed, but you're never going to get to the top of them. By the same token, you know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with, there's vast numbers of time management techniques out there in the wild, some of which, you know, I would say I use myself even today. It's to do with the spirit in which you're approaching them and what it is you think you're going to get out of them. What I'm a lot better at than I was, although still very far from perfect, is not thinking that I'm ever going to achieve some kind of perfect control, perfect productivity, perfect capacity to respond to everything, that I am going to have to choose and leave many things neglected, and even certain friendships and relationships, you know, unnurtured, precisely in order to focus on a few relationships and projects. And to do that job, absolutely, some time management techniques can be a useful organizational tool, but they're held psychologically in a totally different way, right? They're held as sort of, sure, it's good to be a bit organized with how I go about my day. That is not the same as this kind of existential struggle that never reaches a resolution, that we're often approaching these techniques with that in mind, I think, or at least subconsciously.
What is the limit embracing life? Something you get at in the book that, and it sort of comes back to this idea we were talking about earlier with the medieval peasants, that the real problem isn't, I think, as you put it, our limited time. It's that we've adopted this set of ideas about how to use our limited time. Do you want to talk about that?
I think of the limit embracing life as just a sort of umbrella term for the stance I'm trying to sketch out here. And, you know, I'd like to make clear, also trying to step more into myself. I think it's a sort of lifelong challenge. And that is just one which, at least in the context of temporal limits, they're not the only kind, doesn't make it a sort of basic demand of what counts as a meaningful and fulfilling and valuable life that you violate sort of absolutely built-in conditions of being human. So we are here in a limited form. We have limited number of years on the planet, limited number of hours. And if you make your goals, either your sort of sense of a meaningful life, or on a more down-to-earth level, your sense of what would count as a productive day, if you make it sort of infinitely extending and effectively limitless, if you make your sense of self-worth, which I think is another very important part of this, if you feel like you'll only have done enough today if you do more than a human being could do, then it's sort of setting up a game that you can only lose from the beginning. So I think, you know, the idea of embracing your limits is really just about turning more fully and consciously towards the situation that we're all in, not to, you know, just resignedly accept that we're never going to do anything very interesting or meaningful with our lives, but exactly the opposite, to say that, like, okay, now we've come back down to the ground, and that's where we can take one step after another and actually do those meaningful and sometimes, you know, extraordinary things.
Oliver Berkman, his new book is called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. I want to ask you about another idea that you get at, and this is I think this the chapter describes it, the pitfalls of convenience. The way this drive for increased efficiency is, I think you say, warping our relationship with time, this lure of convenience. Talk a little bit about that. That you say convenience makes things easy, but it doesn't really care that easiness is actually the thing that is most valuable. You describe, for example, designing and sending a birthday card to someone online.
Convenience is such a great and vivid example of the way in which if you just seek time efficiency as a goal and doing more and fitting more in and making things take less time, and there's no sort of overarching deeper goal or deeper value than that, you end up in these kind of situations that sap the meaning and the value from life. For a very long time, until recently, I've lived on a different continent than many members of my extended family, and being as hapless as anybody in keeping a schedule that enables me to mail birthday cards to them or birthday presents to them weeks and weeks ahead of time, as you need to, I've ended up using these services. You construct a card online and you put a message in it, and then they print that card locally at the end in the country where it's going to be received, and they mail it, and it only takes a day or two to be mailed instead of a couple of weeks. And I think I've just always been aware, and was always aware while I was doing that, that something is missing here, right? Something has been made much more convenient, and a certain kind of effort has been taken out of the process. And yet somehow the thing that makes the act most meaningful has been taken out of the process too, because we say it's the thought that counts when it comes to a gift, or a card or something like that. But in many ways, it's the effort that counts. In many ways, it's the inconvenience. You know, I think that when I receive a letter or a card or something from somebody who has gone to the trouble of thinking about it ahead of time and writing it out by hand and mailing it, it's the trouble that really resonates there and really makes you feel like you're someone special in their world. So that, I think, is one of many examples where, you know, convenience sort of smooths life out, makes it a lot easier. And then you're like, oh, hang on. Easier wasn't actually what was most important there.
You tell the story of the Bible scholar, Sylvia Kiesmott. Say a little bit about that, because I thought this was, this idea of her realization of, like, I have to figure a way to give things up. We have to give stuff up in order to sort of get to this point. I think it was important.
Yeah, this is, she was working in a university setting in Toronto and largely gave that up for a farm-based life where everything was much more inconvenient. But just, you know, she described this experience of it being like an hour in the morning before she gets her cup of tea because of all the different tasks that need doing to just keep the various animals fed and start the fire that will keep the house warm for the day. And just the realization that these things that feel like chores from the perspective of sort of unnecessary or tedious chores from the perspective of convenience are actually for her, I think, you know, the substance of life. They're the things that she wanted to be doing here on this planet. And the problem with convenience is you think, well, there's something missing from my life, and it's more time, and maybe it is more time in nature and in the natural world in the way that it was for her. But then if you think, well, okay, so I'm going to try and get my work done in like one day less per week so that I have a day to go and do that, you're sort of missing the point, because what you really need to do, I think, is to sort of accept that you're not going to get all that work done in that speed if you want to be more present to the place that you are and the environment that you are, and that there will be sacrifices involved, and that it won't be a matter of just finding a clever way to fit more and more in, that won't actually allow you to preserve to enhance the value that you want to focus on.
You write about being, and I think a lot of us relate to this, paralyzed by the idea that there is a way to do this perfectly. And it's a great fable you tell about this architect in Persia who designs this beautiful mosque. You want to say something about as a setup to this idea? Because I think this is important, the idea of just being so set on it being just right that we don't really get to it at all.
Yeah, this is a lovely story. It's actually a modern fable devised by a philosopher called Kostika Bradatan. And he sort of conjures this story of an architect in Shiraz in Persia who many, many decades ago designed the most beautiful mosque that the world had ever encountered, just to sort of made these plans for a completely unbelievably stunning piece of architecture such that, you know, every builder in the land wanted to have the privilege of building it. Various rival architects wanted to send thieves into his offices at night to steal the plans. Kings were begging him to allow them to give him the money to build it, et cetera, et cetera. And he sort of studied the plans for 3 days and nights and then burned them rather than ever bring this mosque into reality, because he had understood that any attempt to bring this mosque into reality would never preserve the full perfection of the plan, of the idea. There isn't the greatest builder in the world who can build a building without introducing some faults. The moment you bring something into the world of time, decay and the ravages of time, marauding armies, all sorts of things are going to start to undermine the perfection of your vision. And he's just using that to illustrate this idea, which I think is extremely true, that to bring any creative project into reality, and I think the same applies to things that we wouldn't necessarily call creative projects, to bring anything into reality by the standards of your perfect fantasy entails doing it imperfectly. That the very act of bringing it into the real world is to accept a certain amount of falling short of the fantasy. And so if you really are the kind of perfectionist who only wants to start if you're going to make it, if it's going to be perfect, then you're never going to start. And if you're worried that the novel you try to write or the house redecoration you intend to launch, if you're worried that these things are going to be less than perfect, in a way, you can stop worrying because they definitely are going to be less than perfect. And I think that move is something that occurs a lot in this book, and it's very dear to me, that idea of like, you can stop stressing about something if it's definitely going to be that way, rather than constantly trying to fend off the possibility that it might be that way. You can see that, no, this is built into the human situation. So you can stop beating yourself up for failing to find a way around it.
There's this experiment you write about at Harvard, this social psychologist, Daniel Gilbert, which gets to this idea, and this is in a section of the book about, as you put it, becoming a better procrastinator. And the idea of talk a little bit about this study, if you would, because it seems like it's sort of getting at the point of like, you've got to commit to something. At some point, you just need to make the call. Say something about that, if you would.
In this experiment, two groups of participants were given the option to select an art print from a wide variety of them. But then one group was told that they had a month to change their mind, to decide they wanted a different one of the prints instead. And the other group was told that their decision was final. And that was that. And in an attempt to follow up how pleased they were with their choices, the researchers found that people were much more pleased with their choice if they had been told that it was irreversible and irrevocable. So they were happier with what they'd chosen when they didn't have the option of going back and changing it. And I think that makes a sort of intuitive sense when you put it like that, right? That we're sort of tormented by alternative options. And if the alternative options are taken away from us, then there's a sort of relaxation and an ability to just give yourself to the choice that you made. The really, really obvious example of that kind of commitment is marriage. It's not literally the case in most cultures these days that you can't change your mind about a marriage, but there is a level of no going back that is intrinsic to that decision. And I think it's a very deliberate social convention, right? To have people make this kind of commitment that is difficult to go back on, because that's what leads to deep, serious quality relationships. It's not, that's what leads to all the things that both socially and personally marriage needs to be in a society. It's precisely that sort of cutting off the alternatives. So again, it all makes intuitive sense. And yet I think the way that most of us go through most of life, most of the time, is wanting to have it the other way, to keep our options open, to feel in control to achieve the feeling of being in control, but by holding on to this notion that we haven't really fully jumped, that we can change our mind at any moment. And the problem is that, you know, actually that's a decision too. That's a decision to spend your life sort of indecisively holding back from the various experiences that might be open to you.
What did you learn about in writing the book and researching it, the nature of attention? So you write about this. There's a section where you describe as I don't want to give too much away, but you write about this, what you describe as the watermelon problem. And you get this idea of attention, how we think of attention. And I've done this myself, I have to say, thought about and talked about attention as a very finite resource. But you say that's getting it wrong. That's a way that sort of, that we're not understanding it in the same way. We talk about attention and how that fits into the way you're thinking about time.
Right. We talk about attention as a finite resource, and I have no objection to the finite part, because it really is. You know, you can barely focus on more than one thing at once. There are certain special contexts, but where you can. But basically, you can only focus on one thing once. It's very finite. Calling it a resource, to me, slightly understates the problem, because resources are things that we use to make our lives work. You know, food and water and electricity are resources that are vital to life. But you can sort of live without some of them, at least without very much of them, at least for a little bit. You know, if you don't get any food for a day, you will be okay. And people lived without electricity for most of human history. Attention is just, you know, it's too central to life to even make that claim. I think attention just is life. That when we talk about what we mean by a life well lived or a life badly lived, we mean what attention was given to. And at the end of your life, the sort of aggregate of all the things you paid attention to with it will be what your life was. So I do think that the sort of resource talk about attention misses slightly how completely fundamental it is to ask what we are paying attention to, because we are paying with our lives when we do that. And therefore, I think, yes, makes all the more fraught the question of the attention economy that we live in now, that means that it's our eyeballs and our attention that is the currency in which social media and lots of other digital services trade, and they have an interest in making sure we give them our attention. They do not have a particular interest in making sure that we give our attention to anything particularly valuable or socially useful or happiness inducing or anything like that.
Oliver Berkman, his book is 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Let's talk about Steve Young. Maybe explain Steve Young and that story a bit, because I think this gets at another one of these ideas where you know, we're trying to get away from something painful about our experience with the present. And Steve Young and the experience that he goes through, if you don't mind describing it, is a good lesson here.
Steve Young, as was, now much better known as Shinzen Young, a meditation teacher, in his earliest training to become originally a Buddhist monk, he's not a monk today, but to become a Buddhist monk, had to undergo this extraordinarily punishing purification ritual, as it was described, where he had to while living in a solitary life on a Japanese mountainside, had to dump frozen water over his naked body from an old wooden cistern three times a day, you know, to sort of deliberately seek out this kind of suffering. And he describes very vividly this experience of, you know, first of all, doing what most of us would do if we were somehow obliged to be in that situation, which is to try to sort of mentally absent yourself from the experience, to sort of think about something else, you know, concentrate on some happy memory or think about sunbathing at the beach or just, you know, anything really, just to sort of to not be present to those feelings. But what he gradually realized over many, many days of this extraordinary ritual was that, in fact, the more present he was to those experiences, the more he was willing to really feel that ice cold water, the less suffering there was. And he actually says that, you know, he thinks that that ritual developed precisely as what he calls a biofeedback device, you know, to that it was teaching him and training him gradually to be very, very focused on his present moment experience, which is so essential in the life of a meditator, especially a monk, because it was punishing him with extra suffering every time he was distracted or tried to distract himself, and rewarding him with less suffering every time he could really bring his focus to the experience. And another meditation teacher I know, Kenneth Folk, has described it in a slightly different way. He talks about the way that if you fill up your attentional bandwidth with the experience that you're having, there's actually just less bandwidth left over to rail against that experience or to wish that the experience were other than it is. So I guess the reason I bring that up in the context of the book is just that we want, I think, all the time to try to distract ourselves from unpleasant experiences, including the discomfort that's associated with lots of meaningful activities, you know, creative projects that you're not convinced, you're not certain you can succeed at, or conversations with your spouse that you know you need to have, but they're probably going to leave you feeling vulnerable in some way, or all these kind of meaningful things that happen in our lives that trigger some kind of discomfort. And the urge is always, I think, almost always, to try to distract ourselves, to try to think about something else, to reach for the smartphone, whatever it might be. And actually, the possibility that Shinzen Young's experience presents, for me anyway, is that it might be by going more deeply into them that the suffering that they involve is diminished.
I do my share of hiking in the foothills of Salt Lake City. You write about walking, about hiking, taking a walk in the countryside, a particular walk you mention. Talk a little bit about that, if you would. There's a philosopher, Kiran Satya, who talks about this, describes this as atelic. I can't say I've ever heard that term before, atelic activity, the idea that the hike isn't the idea of getting there or getting the job done. It's the thing itself, I guess. You want to say something about that?
We, I think, are completely dominated now culturally and socially by this idea that the real test of using our time well is precisely using it well for some future purpose. That is what Kiran Satya and others would call a telic activity. It's governed by its telos, by the end point that it's leading up to. But his coinage, this idea of an atelic, atelic activity. The idea there is that, you know, we had better have some things in our lives, at least, where it is only the doing of them in themselves that has the value. Otherwise, you know, our whole lives are going to be lived pointed towards the meaning at some future point that is never going to arrive, or alternatively, you know, maybe arise for 1 minute when you pass the examination or you finish the job, and you know, a few days later, it's as if it never happened. Hiking is such a great example. He mentions it, and it's so close to my heart. Sounds like it's close to yours. Just because, you know, if you want to do a hike really efficiently, well, what is a hike? A hike is something you usually like drive to some parking lot, and you either go in a loop back to where you started, or you go to a sort of extreme point and then you turn back and go back to where you started. So either way, the way to do that really efficiently is just not to go in the first place. And
because there you are in the parking lot, why not just stay there?
Exactly. Right. Why not just never get in the car from your home in the first place, right? If that's what your goal is, then that's what you would do. But of course, that's not why people go on hikes. To some extent, people go for their physical health, and they maybe go to create amazing images to put on Instagram. So there are instrumental reasons that people might go hiking. But the fundamental reason is just to be hiking. And another way of thinking about that, as Satya points out, is like, you know, you're never going to get to the point where you've done all the hiking you planned to do in your life. You may have to stop, and eventually you will stop, but it won't be because you've reached some conclusion in the project of hiking. You just hiked while you did it because it was a good thing to do.
Well, along that line, we should mention Rod Stewart and his hobby, which is an atelic activity for sure. And I remember reading about this too. He is obsessed with model trains. And in fact, I also read, I don't know if – I'm sure you read about this as well. He takes – when he tours, apparently he takes trains with him to his hotel rooms.
Right. He books another hotel room for his model train layout, which if you're Rod Stewart, you can do that. Who's going to say no? I think what I love about this anecdote, and he has given a bunch of interviews now about his model train layout, which is a vast and elaborate historical American city based on an amalgam of Chicago and New York. And it's got all these kind of grimy sidewalks and skyscrapers and all sorts of, you know, roads as well as the trains. And it's an amazing thing from the photographs I've seen. And, you know, it's just so obvious that for someone in his position, that must be something that he's doing out of the love of doing it, because it doesn't feed into his brand. If anything, it plays rather against his brand. It's a little nerdy for his brand. It's not something that he is ever going to make money at. He, you know, certainly not compared to the extraordinary money that he makes through his music. And he actually says in these interviews, he's not even that good at a lot of the electrical wiring part of this job. He actually ends up paying someone to do certain parts of the wiring of the model train layout. And there's just something very touching about that. You know, when you see that, somebody who is clearly so driven, because you don't get to that position and sustain it without being driven as a rock star, who presumably has all sorts of instrumental values guiding his activities when he tours, you know, to whether it is to make money or just to sort of show himself and the world that he's still got it, or whether he just thinks it's really important that he bring the pleasure that he brings to his audiences, whatever it is, it's instrumental. He's doing it for some, to sort of add up to something. And then you get this thing in the context of that, where he just like, oh, what he wants to do to relax is just be absorbed in his trains. I find it very, very sort of moving in a way, because he's obviously decided that this is actually a central necessity for a meaningful life for someone in his position. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about one of the things you mentioned is the book that you wrote the first draft of it. Under lockdown in New York City. And maybe this is the inevitable question about COVID-19 and how this relates, but say a little bit about that, because you describe this moment as having the potential for being the great pause, I guess.
Yeah, it was some later parts of this book that I drafted in during lockdown. Other parts of it, as my editor would happily point out, had been being completed for a much more annoyingly long period than that. I didn't get it all done in the last year and a half, sadly. But yeah, I think that it was a really interesting opportunity to be writing this book sort of through that period. And I think that it has been a really extraordinary opportunity for people to reevaluate what they're doing with their time, you know, really a reevaluation that they have to carry out whether they like it or not. This moment when firstly, you know, the death and bereavement all around us makes it so clear that time is precious and fragile. And then also, you know, certain things we were no longer able to do, socializing with friends. In my case, you know, I was singing in an amateur choir and I didn't realize how much I needed that until it was suspended because it suddenly became the most dangerous thing you could do in COVID times. And also things that people stopped doing, like commuting if they were working from home, or, you know, staying at their desk till 6:30 in the evening just to appear hardworking if they no longer had to do that, that they were suddenly quite happy to not do. So I think as we head out stumblingly and haltingly of the pandemic, it is a time when, quoting another writer here, but who pointed out that like there was an opportunity to Marie Kondo our time, you know, to ask what we really want to keep as we move forward, and what of the old ways of using time prior to the pandemic, what we might be willing to might make more sense to jettison permanently on an ongoing basis.
Let me ask you finally. I wanted to. You know, there were these various principles that you get into, and but I wanted to, I guess, finally come down to this epiphany you mentioned from James Hollis, the idea, this kind of moment where she had this realization about hating her life. Or will you say something about that finally, and why you sort of round out the book in some ways with this moment?
This is an anecdote from a therapist whose work I really respect, James Hollis, about a client who was traveling on a business trip high over the American Midwest reading a book when she suddenly has this thought, you know, I hate my life. You know, I hate what I'm doing with my life now. And it's not, I don't mean being on the plane. I mean, you know, it's just there's something about being in that slightly out of the norm condition that enabled her to connect to this truth that she'd been dimly aware of all the rest of the time. I think we all have epiphanies of some nature. It's not always so sudden, not always that we hate our lives. Maybe that there are many aspects of our lives that we deeply cherish, but there is this great value in being able to somehow see your life from a sort of an oblique angle, or from above, or from the side somehow, and to just get that slightly fresher perspective on how you're using your time, either to make radical changes, as in her case, or perhaps to recommit with a new level of consciousness, you know, to things that you're already doing, and to find the meaning through either of those two routes that you might otherwise have lacked.
She described it, or you describe it, as a kind of an inner shift that happens.
Right. I think all of this we've been talking about is about a sort of gradual or sudden changed orientation inside to what you're doing with your time on the outside. And it might lead to radical changes in what you're doing on the outside. It might not. Either way, it'll be a sort of a stepping into a more authentic kind of existence.
Oliver Berkman, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oliver Berkman, his book is 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.